Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And coming up on the programme, we'll be talking about a couple of wars already in train. The conflict in the Middle East, with dozens more reported dead in Gaza, a deadly Hezbollah attack on an Israeli military base, and a potentially very significant deployment of US troops and a new anti-missile system to Israel. And we'll hear from our correspondent on the front line in eastern Ukraine as the war there with Russia continues to cause immense damage. But we're going to begin in another part of the world altogether with fears of war. We're heading to East Asia, where Taiwan's president, Lai Ching-te, has been holding emergency meetings with security chiefs as China has conducted what are thought to be its biggest war games yet around the self-governing island. The spokeswoman for Taiwan's presidential office, Karen Guo, urged Beijing to end the drills.
At present, the international community's consensus is to maintain peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and the Indo-Pacific region. China should face the fact and the existence of the Republic of China-Taiwan, respect the choice of the Taiwanese people for a democratic and free lifestyle, and refrain from military provocations that would jeopardise the peace and stability of the region and threaten Taiwan's democracy and freedom.
The Chinese government has always insisted that Taiwan is part of its own territory, but last Thursday, in a speech in Taipei marking Taiwan's National Day, President Lai insisted that Beijing had, in his words, no right to represent the island. Today, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Mao Ning repeated Beijing's opposition to Taiwanese independence.
Taiwan independence and peace in the Taiwan Strait are irreconcilable. The provocations from pro-independence forces will inevitably face countermeasures. China has always been committed to maintaining peace and stability in the region, and this is evident to the countries in the area. Therefore, if you are concerned about peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, the first thing you should do is oppose Taiwan independence.
Chinese war games around Taiwan are nothing new, but what are the size of these drills? These people in the city of Hsinchu in northern Taiwan gave their reaction.
We're not worried at all, because we trust our military, that it has the capability to defend us against any forces that would want to invade. We're not worried one bit. We're living here very happily. We came past here and are very happy that we could see jets taking off and landing. I'm not scared at all.
I have total confidence in our country and our national army. But normal people are still worried there could be accidental fire, which would severely impact cross-strait relations and our political scene. But basically, we Taiwanese are just honest and simple people who want to live and work in peace.
And what of Taiwan's own military capabilities? Well, a year ago, NewsHour's Nuala McGovern was given rare access to some of those military facilities.
I'm under a single aircraft hangar. This is bomb-proof. And I've also got with me Colonel Lin. He is the political warfare director of this unit and has been with the Air Force for 26 years. So what do you think is the biggest challenge when it comes to being prepared?
Frankly, that will be demanding our every single pilot to be as prepared, as trained as possible for the least desired scenario that we want to see. You will find that the security situation is getting worse if you're looking at a global picture. From our point of view, what we do is to prepare ourselves the best we can in accordance to our regulations, and we do our best to protect our country.
Well, let's pick up on this now with our correspondent in Taipei, Rupert Wingfield-Hayes. Rupert, what's your assessment of the size and significance of these drills?
Well, they are absolutely, as the Taiwanese government has reported, the largest one-day exercises that we have seen so far. They have counted 125 Chinese aircraft, military aircraft taking part in 17 ships, including crossing the median line on repeated occasions, and including for the first time what appears to be a Chinese carrier battle group off the east coast of Taiwan. So in the Pacific Ocean, not in the Taiwan Straits, but on the other side of Taiwan, the Chinese aircraft carrier Liaoning and the flotilla around that ship have taken part in this for the first time. So this is different in scale and also in nature. We didn't see any ballistic missiles being fired as we've seen before, but instead what we've seen is what the Chinese are calling combined operations between air and sea. This is air and sea battle. It's about cutting off Taiwan from the outside world and striking its ports and its air bases, and also preventing any resupply operations that could come from the east of the island, from the Pacific, or from Taiwan's allies, in the scenario that they're playing out in this exercise.
And I guess, I mean, well, you tell me, it's not, certainly it's significant that this is, as you say, the biggest, but I mean, it's fairly continuous pressure, this, isn't it, from these war games, and presumably that takes its own toll on the Taiwanese military.
It does, and absolutely, that point is really well taken, Tim, because, you know, if this was coming out of the blue, out of nowhere, and we saw this sort of scale of operation today, I think it would be headline news around the world, it would be seen as a massive escalation. But as it is, many people just shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, it's another day between China and Taiwan, because since the middle of 2022, we have seen pretty much daily operations around Taiwan continuously, often a handful of aircraft and ships, but I've seen many days over the last year and a half when we've seen 40, 50 aircraft every day, sometimes for weeks at a time. And it goes up and it goes down, depending on how Beijing wants to turn up the pressure on Taiwan and on Taiwan's allies and supporters elsewhere, what sort of messaging it wants to send. But this pressure is continuous, and it has been described by the head of the Taiwan Navy as an anaconda strategy of sort of gradually squeezing the life out of Taiwan's military capabilities just through exhaustion. There's some, in some days they're sending 25%, sometimes 40% of their naval assets out into the Taiwan Straits every day. So, you know, yeah, absolutely, it is continuous and is exhausting, and it is deliberately so on the part of China.
And in terms of the, what still strikes me as he's probably not that new, but relatively new president of Taiwan, Lai Ching-te, is he seen in Taiwan as somebody who is a bit more pro-independence?
Yes, I think, you know, deep down, I think a lot of people here would acknowledge that Lai Ching-te is from the pro-independence wing of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, much more so than his predecessor, President Tsai Ing-wen, who was very, very cautious. He said very openly he has no intention of changing the status quo.
Rupert Wingfield-Hayes in Taipei, thanks ever so much for joining us. Well, clearly in all this, the United States remains absolutely key in the strategic balance in the region. And it's also true that in a US presidential election which sees the candidates and the parties fiercely divided on lots of issues, both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump do want to paint themselves as tough on Beijing, as hawks who won't fear conflict, if that's where all this leads. What do people in China make of that? Some Chinese analysts have said the choice between Harris and Trump is akin to two bowls of poison. Our China correspondent, Laura Bicker, visited a local park in Beijing to gather the thoughts of people there.
In a clearing in the trees, a pensioner is in full song as he elegantly spins his partner. The music is Chinese, but the dance is Latin. This group of seniors meet here regularly to learn new moves. And as the US election approaches, its impact on the two superpowers is on their minds.
I'm worried that the Sino-US relations are getting tense, which is a zero-sum game. It does no good to China or the US. As ordinary people, we hope the two countries can coexist peacefully with each other so that they can both develop.
There are also concerns about another trade war, and many feel the US is imposing tariffs on China's goods to suppress its growth.
The tariffs will also increase the burden to the U.S. people. Increasing tariffs will cause the increase of life expenses, and ordinary people will suffer in the end. The two countries should work for win-win instead of destructive competition, which is not good for both sides.
Instead of watching the dancers, many gather to listen and add to our conversation.
I prefer Trump, although he imposes economic sanctions on China. He does not wish to start or fight a war. Biden starts more wars, so more ordinary people dislike him. It's Biden who supports Ukraine at the war, and both Russia and Ukraine suffer great loss from the war.
This echoes a key message from Chinese state media, which has been quick to blame the current Biden administration for its unwavering support of Israel and Ukraine. China portrays itself as a peacemaker and the US as a troublemaker. As his four-year-old plays on the slide, this father believes Kamala Harris will keep a cooler head when it comes to one of the biggest flashpoints between the US and China, Taiwan.
I don't think there's a good future. It's a global economy. I don't want my son go to the military.
China claimed the self-governing island of Taiwan as its own, and President Xi has said reunification is inevitable, vowing to retake it by force if necessary. Joe Biden has insisted the US would defend it, and if Kamala Harris agrees, some fear it could lead to conflict. As we walk through the park, past stalls selling grilled octopus, we find 17-year-old Lucy on an exercise bike. She hopes to study in America one day.
I'm quite excited to see there is a female candidate. Harris' candidacy marks an important step forward for gender equality. And it's encouraging to see her as a presidential candidate.
Why do you think it's so difficult between the U.S. and China?
Previously, China lagged behind the U.S., but now China has risen up in all aspects, which may lead to the U.S. worrying about their number one place in the world.
There is a lack of trust on both sides. And most people we talk to believe that no matter who wins the White House, that will not change.
And that was Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, reporting from Beijing. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. Coming up on the programme, we'll be asking if there's such a thing as too much football, or soccer, if that's the way you spell it, to the detriment of the top players.
Everybody acts in self-interest, but when you add all three sort of driving parties together, it does significantly increase. And we've seen some players being expected to play 60 or 70 games over the course of the season.
More on that in just over 10 minutes. Headlines this hour. Officials in northern Gaza say 10 people have been killed in an Israeli strike on a food distribution centre, as Israel has been accused of planning to lay siege to the area. We'll be looking at that in the second half of the programme. And as we've heard, China says it has completed large-scale military exercises encircling Taiwan. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC, with me, Tim Franks. In Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region, Russia has advanced swiftly in the past few months. It's pushed the front line back now to just outside the crucial transport hub of Pokrovsk. Fighting in this sector is intense, with the Ukrainian military reporting nearly 150 battles every day as it tries to stall Russia's momentum. Just 2 months ago, the city was considered a relatively safe place. Around 14,000 civilians still remain in Pokrovsk, war-weary, and many of them desperate now for the war to end at any cost. From the front line, the BBC's Jogita Lemaya has this report.
I'm at a Ukrainian military stabilization unit, which is not far from the front line outside of Pokrovsk. We can't identify its exact location for safety reasons. These are basically units that are about 10 to 12 kilometers from the front line, where the first line of medical treatment is available for injured soldiers. This is the hottest front line in the war. And they've told us that it's been really quite intense here over the last 1 or 2 months.
My name is Alexander. I'm chief of medical unit 25 Air Assault Brigade. It's the most dangerous line in all front lines. And of course, we have a lot of injured soldiers.
Even where we are here right now, we are under the threat of artillery strikes. And if we just stepped outside of this building, there's a threat of being seen and struck by Russian drones. It's about 2 hours from sunset, and we've just had about 6 or 7 injured soldiers brought in, some quite serious. There's one soldier who's just walked past who has a bandage to his eye quite visibly. It's bleeding. And we were told before his arrival that he was actually injured at 11 in the morning. But essentially the reason why it takes so long to evacuate is because they have to wait for a relatively safe time to evacuate because of the ever-present threat of bombs being dropped from Russian drones.
He has injury of face, skull, skull trauma.
The delays have consequences. One of the soldiers has serious brain trauma. In the past 24 hours, 2 have been brought in dead. What we see points to the ferocity of the battle for Pokrovsk and what it's costing Ukraine. We're with an evacuation unit in an ambulance in the city of Pokrovsk. They're here to evacuate 2 elderly women. And one of them actually lives on the eastern edge of the city, very close to the Russian positions. This is one of the most dangerous districts of the city, volunteer Serhii tells us. Eighty-year-old Nadia Lebed is disabled, living alone in the dark in her home. The volunteers we're with carry her out. I'm going to fall, she screams. They reassure her. Once on the van, she cries. I'm going to die. This damn war. Why does Putin want more land? Doesn't he have enough? Another evacuee, Victoria, says she can't believe the front line moved so quickly to Pokrovsk.
The neighboring towns have been wiped out and drones buzz near our windows all the time. I have constant panic attacks. We should negotiate. There's nothing left standing in the areas Russia has taken anyway.
There are pockets of destruction in Pokrovsk, but the city has not been bombed out in the way that we've seen other cities that have been fiercely fought over, like what we saw in Bakhmut, for example. But 3/4 of the people who lived here have left, and the government is actively asking those who are still here to evacuate. And that's evidence of how quickly Russia's advanced here in the east. Up until 2 months ago, this was a safe pit stop. And now the front lines just outside Pokrovsk.
Vadim fires a Soviet-era howitzer gun. It blows dust and dried leaves off the ground. In the relative safety of a bunker nearby, he tells us it's been nearly a year since he saw his family.
Yes, we are tired. Many of our men have died. Many are wounded. Negotiations are necessary, but not on Russia's terms. They need to be on our terms.
The Ukrainian soldier Vadim, ending that report by the BBC's Yogita Lemaya. We led the programme today talking about China's war games around Taiwan and heard just now about Russia's advances in Ukraine. We're going to hear from someone now who believes that the BBC itself is caught up in the pressure exerted by China and Russia, this time in the battle for the airwaves. The BBC Director General Tim Davie is making a speech right now saying that the world faces an all-out assault on truth as cuts to the funding of the BBC and in particular this channel, the BBC World Service, and its dozens of language services has meant the vacuum being filled by Russian and Chinese broadcasting. The World Service used to be funded directly and separately by the Foreign Ministry, the Foreign Office, although it's always maintained editorial independence of government. That changed a few years back when that funding was stopped and the BBC had to pay for the World Service out of its own budget, funded by what's called the licence fee, which is paid by individual British households. Tim Davies been speaking to my BBC colleague, Nick Robinson.
If you look at the long-term trends, this is about decades of strategy where I think malign powers, frankly, Russia, China, others, see the benefit of investing heavily in media, you know, bordering into pure propaganda, but often just taking media assets, taking frequencies, and broadcasting in a world which 75% of the world now doesn't have a free press. I mean, we obsess a lot about the ins and outs of the BBC, appropriately. But if you look at the big macro trends, they are disturbing. More and more, you cannot speak your mind. You can't have the process we're going through in terms of a free press interrogating politicians. And the World Service is a precious, incredibly important asset that we need to nurture. And that goes beyond just, frankly, BBC campaigning.
You talk about taking frequencies. Now, there was a big change, wasn't there, where the BBC was asked to pay for the World Service. It used to be done directly
Indeed.
By the Foreign Office. And some language services closed. Are you arguing today in this speech you've got at the Future Resilience Forum that Russia and China are filling that gap?
Well, we see that. We see where we withdraw. So, as an example, in Lebanon, and we haven't closed a lot of language services. What we've had to do, inevitably, as the BBC has had tight funding settlements, and there's only so much you can ask of the UK licence fee payer to pay for language services appropriately. And as you say, for decades, this was funded by government. And I think there are very clear examples where we've seen where we've taken away BBC Arabic on radio, for instance. It's on other platforms. Others have come in, Russian-backed media coming into Lebanon, and I've got other examples where you see China and Russia deliberately spending billions of dollars, Nick, billions, on that strategic objective. This has to be a matter long-term for the central government decision-making to say, OK, we have to, as a country, invest, and I don't think it's appropriate to charge all of this to the UK licence fee payer. It is a strategic decision. One of the things that I think we should value, I mean, in this country, we do self-flagellation pretty well. But if you go around the world, by the way, if I want cheering up, get on a plane pretty much anywhere and talk about the BBC World Service, the things we do to build the most trusted news service in the world, that, I agree, Nick, is something that every household should not be paying for, things that they don't consume.
Are ministers listening?
I think they are.
And that was the BBC's Director General, Tim Davies, speaking about the BBC World Service to my colleague, Nick Robinson. You are listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We've got much more to cover in the next 30 minutes. Stay with us if you can. Welcome back to NewsHour. How much of the world's favourite sport is too much? Today, the union that represents football players, or soccer players if you're in the United States, along with a group of European leagues, have brought a legal complaint against the sport's world governing body, FIFA. They accuse FIFA of abusive conduct over its dominance of the international football calendar. Kieran Maguire is a specialist in football finance at the University of Liverpool and co-host of the Price of Football podcast.
If we look at what has happened in recent years, FIFA has, first of all, expanded the FIFA International World Cup. That's now got more teams in. And from 2025 onwards, the FIFA Club World Cup, which used to have seven teams, is expanding to 32 and is now becoming a tournament that, for the clubs that make the final stretches of the competition, will last the best case of a month. If you then combine that with an extended UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Europa Conference League, what we are seeing is a significant increase in the demands in terms of the FIFA Pro, the players' unions, members, and a squeeze in terms of their ability to have some time off work, spend time with their families, and also to be at peak performance when they are playing football matches.
Right. And just for clarity for our international audience, when you're talking about UEFA, that's the European football governing body who hold major competitions themselves. Some people listening to this might think, well, look, international football is a remarkably well paid. I mean, if they have to sort of put in a bit of an extra shift, how much does it matter? Is it about spending more time with their families, or actually is there a real threat to their welfare?
Well, we have seen an increase in the number of soft tissue injuries undertaken by players and incurred by players in recent years. If we take a look at the most recent major matches, as far as European football was concerned, we had the UEFA Champions League final take place earlier this year. It has to be honest, it was a forgettable game of football, unless you were a Real Madrid fan, in the sense that the standard of football involved was not particularly high. That was very shortly followed by the European Championships over the course of the summer, which took place in Germany. And again, more teams involved, but the quality of the football was relatively mediocre. There were a couple of outstanding games, but not many of them.
I guess the argument that FIFA always invokes is that, look, I mean, it actually, when you compare it to the amount of football there is in domestic leagues, what they organise is an absolutely tiny proportion of the games that are played, but they are hugely important, disproportionately important in terms of funding grassroots development around the world. How strong is that argument?
Everybody acts in self-interest, but when you add all three sort of driving parties together, it does significantly increase. And we've seen some players being expected to play 60 or 70 games over the course of the season.
And that was Kieran Maguire, football finance expert at the University of Liverpool. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC, with me, Tim Franks. And let's head to the conflict in the Middle East now. In a moment, we'll hear about a potentially very significant move by the US military, and also later from our Gaza correspondent about a surge in deaths there. But we're going to start with the fighting across the Israeli-Lebanese border. There has been wide agreement that Israel's caused immense damage to the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia in Lebanon. But last night, Hezbollah showed that it can still cause damage. It launched a drone strike on an Israeli military base, which killed at least four soldiers and injured dozens of others. Rafi Sheva is with the Israeli Ambulance Service.
When we arrived, we saw a very serious scene of a UAV hit. There were many wounded, wounded by the blast and wounded by shrapnel, who were injured in all parts of their bodies. This is a major incident in terms of casualties. We gave life-saving treatment to the injured. We managed the scene of an incident with many casualties. We sorted the casualties quickly and evacuated them to the hospitals in the area.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner is a spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces. Lieutenant Colonel, thanks for your time. I guess this shows that Hezbollah is still able to hit you despite all your efforts.
Thanks, Tim. Indeed, Hezbollah has been planning for 20 years this war. They had planned to conduct thousands of attacks per day. And so, yes, they still have capabilities. We are defeating them and have indeed had a huge impact on their leadership and operational capabilities and on their staging grounds on the borders. But yesterday, as you rightly pointed out, they proved once again that they are a lethal force that has been empowered by Iran. And they have very lethal means of warfare, as this is the challenge we face.
But I guess the question is whether they can be subdued purely militarily, and also at what cost? I mean, given the international condemnation there has been of what's happened with Israeli incursions into UN bases.
So here's what we know. We know that the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701 was supposed to ensure that Hezbollah does not have the weapons of warfare at all, and definitely not on the border with Israel in the south of Lebanon. Unfortunately, that didn't deliver, and that's why we're operating. Of course, we understand that there needs to be a diplomatic assurance that creates the conditions that Hezbollah will not have that power, will not have those tools, and will not have the ability to launch a 7th of October-like attack that they plan to do. That is where we currently are.
You know, but that gives you no right to violate the sanctity of UN bases, which is what's happened and which has caused international condemnation.
Yeah, of course, that is. There have been a couple of incidents, and indeed, the United Nations are not the target, and there is a battle zone that is taking place where there is an immense battle in some places, and there can be mistakes on the battlefield. We have and did ask the UNIFIL to evacuate from the war zone, from the combat zone.
Which you've got absolutely no right to do. I mean, they're there as a result of a UN Security Council resolution. Israel can't unilaterally demand that they withdraw.
We've asked, they decided to stay, and there are dangers in staying in a combat zone. We will go out and continue to operate in order to try and minimize that impact. But if, you know, the BBC were yesterday visited villages and down in the south of Lebanon, where just a few hundred meters away from UN positions, you see entrance points to tunnels, rocket launchers, weaponry. This is the combat zone that Hezbollah has established within the realm of the responsibility of UNIFIL. So if you expect us not to take those out because UNIFIL will say we don't want to evacuate, okay, we'll say we will push forward, we will fulfill our military goals, we will do it as best as we can to limit the impact on UNIFIL. UNIFIL is definitely not the enemy. We suggest they evacuate for their own safety.
Well, you talk about UNIFIL definitely not being the enemy. I mean, to turn your attention briefly to Gaza, I mean, I'm sure you would insist that the civilians of Gaza are not your enemy. And yet, more than 60 people are reported, many of whom are clearly non-combatants. I mean, a large number have been children, have died in the last 24 hours as a result of Israeli airstrikes on a hospital, on a food distribution centre and so forth. I mean, the killing continues apace, doesn't it?
I think we need to differentiate between Lebanon and Gaza. There are different war goals for the different arenas. And of course, the most important thing with the arena in the south with Gaza is that Hamas, first of all, let the 101 remaining hostages free. And we have to make sure that Hamas, as our goal has been dictated, do not have the power to conduct terrorist attacks ever again.
And you still have a responsibility to protect civilians as far as you
absolutely,
can.
Absolutely. And the fact that Hamas are intentionally, and other organizations, other terrorist organizations, are intentionally positioning themselves within the boundaries or in a parking lot of a hospital goes to show what they're about. Now, we can utilize all of the tools that we have, including intelligence and surveillance and in some cases forewarning in order to alleviate and do the distinction that is required by us in those laws of armed conflict. Absolutely, that is what we will continue to do. But this is precisely what the enemy is doing. He's taking advantage of the rules-based system to try and limit our ability to operate against them and change the reality. We have to change the reality, Tim.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, thank you very much. Well, the deadly Hezbollah attack on the Israeli military base was used relatively low-tech, low-flying drones. The US is, in contrast, sending some of the most powerful, high-flying, high-tech hardware to Israel in an effort to boost anti-missile defence. The THAAD system will also involve the deployment of 100 or more US troops to operate it. Comes as Israel prepares to hit back against Iran following its missile barrage of a couple of weeks ago into Israel. Brendan Kearney is a retired US Marines colonel. Brendan Kearney, thanks for joining us. I mean, this capability is significant, isn't it? This THAAD deployment.
It is, Tim. It's a very capable system. It's very mobile. And it can get into Israel quickly and then get out of Israel quickly. And it doesn't require a tremendous number of people. I think, as you mentioned, it's going to be probably somewhere approximately 100 U.S. military personnel that will be running the system.
Yeah, but I guess they will be on an air base, you imagine. And we've seen that air bases are potentially rich targets for, I mean, not just Iran, but also Hezbollah.
Oh, anywhere in Israel is a potential target. You know, a lot of that targeting or lack of targeting that Hezbollah has fired of the missiles they fire out of Lebanon, it's indiscriminate.
But the point is, I guess it's a potential risk to those U.S. troops. And then if one were injured or killed, the U.S. might be drawn more heavily, more directly into this conflict.
Well, there is that risk. There is no doubt. There is no argument about that. Certainly some of those personnel could be subject, could become casualties. And would that draw them into a larger conflict? I'm not sure about that. The United States is making a knowing decision to go ahead and put the equipment and the personnel into Israel. They'll integrate with the Israeli defense system. And, you know, primarily, they'll be going ahead and looking to take care of any incoming missiles from Iran.
Yeah, and do you think that that suggests that the assumption here is that Israel is going to hit Iran hard, and then that will not be the end of it? Iran itself will retaliate in an even greater way than it did a couple of weeks ago.
Well, you know, this ever-increasing escalation of conflict is something we've been worried about in that part of the world for decades. And in the past, it has not taken place. You have an exchange, and then both sides seemingly agree to stand down. So we all have our fingers crossed that this is going to stop at some stage and not escalate to a general conflict throughout the region.
Brendan Kearney, former U.S. Marines colonel, thank you very much for joining us. A public inquiry has opened in England today into the 2018 Novichok nerve agent poisonings allegedly perpetrated by Russia. The target was Sergei Skripal, a former Russian spy who's thought to have worked for British intelligence. He and his daughter were left critically ill. 4 months later, a woman, Dawn Sturgis, died after inadvertently being exposed to the Novichok agent. Well, joining us now is Marie Lennon, the presenter of the Salisbury Poisonings podcast. Marie, what is this inquiry intending to establish?
Yes, good afternoon. Well, this inquiry is about the circumstances of Dawn's death. What led to it? Could it have been prevented? And where responsibility lies? Of course, the poisoning of Dawn Sturgis is very closely linked to the incident involving the Skripals, but this is about Dawn. Of course, she lived in Wiltshire where this happened and was completely unconnected with the Skripals. The inquiry will hear from the people who responded to and investigated what happened to Dawn, including paramedics, hospital staff, local and counter-terror police, public health and others. It's also important to say that the reason this is an inquiry is not only because the scale of the questions around Dawn's death is so vast, but also that some of the evidence will need to be heard in private because it relates to national security and intelligence gathering. The Salisbury Poisonings podcast will be at the inquiry every day it sits to bring listeners the testimony and make sense of what happens. And at the heart of all of it is essentially, how did a 44-year-old woman, a mum of three, how was she killed with a deadly nerve agent like Novichok in a county like Wiltshire?
Yeah, well, Wiltshire in southern England. And I mean, she died several months after that attempt on the Skripals, didn't she?
She did. And that is a very important part of this inquiry, because, as you know, the Skripals were poisoned, and it's alleged that the Novichok was smeared on the front door handle of Sergei Skripal in the city of Salisbury. There was a huge investigation. Parts of the city was closed off. There was a massive decontamination effort. The Skripals remarkably survived the attack, as did the police officer who was caught up in it. And they were discharged from hospital and the city reopened. And for lots of people living here, it felt at the time that that was it and that everyone could recover from what happened. And then we heard in the June of that year, 4 months later, that two people were in hospital, Dawn Sturgis and her partner, Charlie Rowley. And it's thought that the reason that she came into contact with Novichok is that Charlie found the container. It was disguised as a bottle of designer perfume. He saw it discarded in a bin in Salisbury and gave it to his partner as a gift and didn't have any idea what was inside. And the questions are, how was this deadly chemical weapon undetected in the city for so long and allowed to cause such devastation for the local community? That's part of what this inquiry will aim to establish. It's worth quickly saying that the Russian government, the Russian state, even though they were accused by the UK government of being behind this attack, they deny and have always denied any connection to what happened in Salisbury.
Marie Lennon, presenter of the Salisbury Poisonings podcast, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. You with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Let's return to something I mentioned earlier in the interview with the spokesman from the Israel Defence Forces, the missile strikes in Gaza. Officials from the Hamas-run health ministry there say that an Israeli school, on a school in Gaza used to shelter displaced Palestinians in the centre of the Gaza Strip has killed at least 22 people, including 15 children. And that in total, along with drone and other air attacks, more than 60 people have been killed by Israeli strikes over the last 24 hours. One resident at the hospital compound in Deir al-Balah in the centre of the Gaza Strip, Mohammed Wadi, said her family had lost everything.
They hit our tents, burnt our children. My thighs were burnt. My mattress was burnt. Everything was destroyed, including my daughter's clothes. I no longer have any clothes for them. Everything has been burnt. There's no security. Where should I take my daughters? Winter is coming. There's no bedding, no clothes, nothing. I'm devastated.
Well, joining us now is our Gaza correspondent, Rushdie Abu Alouf, who's based in Istanbul. Rushdie, a whole bunch of strikes there have been over the last 24 hours, dozens reported dead. What do you read into what is going on in Gaza?
Yeah, there is a significant escalation in the situation in the north and in the south. While the focus was in the north, where Israeli issued fresh evacuation order for about 300,000 or 400,000 people who remain in northern Gaza. They asked them to leave the north to go south for safety. And within this safe area, yesterday, two significant airstrikes. One hit a school, 22 people were killed, including 15 children, according to Hamas-run health ministry. It's a school belonging to the UN, and where we believe about 500 to 700 people are taking the school as a shelter. It was bombed last night, and overnight, a significant strike hit a place called Al-Aqsa Hospital. It's one of the few remaining functioning hospital in the south. And in every space of this hospital, there are displaced people, people who were fled their homes in the north, and they are taking the hospital as shelter. About 30 tents were burned out of this strike, and four people were killed, according to Hamas, including a couple, a husband and his wife. They were killed. About 40 people were seriously injured. This is the place that Israel is pushing the people in the north to go south. I've been talking to those people in Jabalia refugee camp. At least one person told me this morning there is no point of leaving the north while the south is not safer. Well, what is happening in the north? Back a year ago, there was Israeli general evacuation order to all people in the north to go south. Those people remain. They either didn't want to go or they don't have the money or they are sick. So they decided not to leave the north. Now, we believe that Israel is tightening the blockade around the Jabalia refugee camp and Beit Lahia northwest and Beit Hanun northeast. What happened overnight is that people who were without food and without medicine since October the 1st, they went to one of the UNRWA warehouses where they keep some of the food, try to take food from it. And there was an airstrike in that area that killed 10 people. So very significant raising in the number of people killed around the north and the south in Gaza.
Rushdie Abu Alouf, our correspondent who covers affairs in Gaza, was based in Gaza for very many years. Thank you very much indeed. Now, the hunt for extraterrestrial life, or more accurately, the possibility of extraterrestrial life, is due to blast off in a new direction today in just over 2 hours as a NASA spacecraft is scheduled to launch from Florida en route to Europa, one of the moons which orbits the planet Jupiter, a full 628 million kilometres away, half a billion miles from Earth. Dr. Leisha Ray is senior lecturer in space and planetary physics at Lancaster University in England. Dr. Ray, thanks for joining us. Why Europa, and what is this spacecraft and its probe possibly looking for?
Right. So Europa is one of the best possible locations that we really have to detect the building blocks of life. So what this spacecraft is looking for is it's going to be looking for any signatures of organic materials, the stuff, carbon, oxygen, you know, the things that make up you or me. It wants to better determine the nature of the salty ice oceans that are underneath the ice shell, because we know that you need water for life. And any characterization of the moon in terms of energy sources or thermal vents in the deep interior, that's going to help as well, because we know we need some source of energy and heating as well for life to come to be.
So not just chemicals, it's about the right environment. But I mean,
yes.
From what I've been reading, there is a crust, it's a bit more than a crust, because it's 25 kilometers thick around the moon. How on earth presumably there's no drilling, but how can that be seen through?
Right. So they do have a radar that they hope will be able to penetrate the ice and look underneath. But you can actually learn a lot about the thickness of the ocean from looking at other measurements. So the magnetic field around the moon, not generated by the moon, but that can tell us about the thickness of the ocean. You can learn a lot about the gravity and the interior structure by how the spacecraft moves as it orbits the moon. So there's a lot that we can learn without having to actually dig a hole down and pretend we're ice fishing on Europa, which obviously isn't possible.
Yeah. I mean, am I right in saying that one of the things that's very exciting about this is that this isn't what we consider to be the sort of the near bit of the solar system, in other words, Mars, that this is, you know, a long way away.
It is. It is. And Jupiter is what makes it all possible. So Jupiter's massive. It's only 10 times smaller than the sun. And the tidal forces, so just like we have tides on our seas here, high tide and low tide, the same forces that create our tides heat up the interiors of the Galilean moons, and so make them possible locations where we have the right conditions for life. And that's really fantastic.
And I presume, I mean, if there is the possibility of life in two locations in our solar system, then that just increases the probability of life actually existing somewhere else in the universe.
Yeah, the fact that the possibility exists in multiple locations, it means that it's not something that maybe needs exactly the same conditions everywhere to occur. So if we could really say, yes, Europa, that's the ticket, that has all the necessary building blocks. We know Earth did it. Mars is closer. Maybe there was something there. It really starts to open up the possibilities.
Dr. Leisha Ray, fantastic to have you on the program. A very exciting space launch ahead. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and all the team here in London, thanks for listening.